Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM and FM HD1. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. In this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1051, I will have two segments. First, I will speak with Michael Ibrahim, National Arab Orchestra founder and music director. We will talk about the National Arab Orchestra and the upcoming Houston event, Treasures of the East, Timeless Classics of the Arab World, which will highlight some of the Arab world's most treasured pieces of music with a performance that will showcase the rich beauty and diverse heritage of the Arab world with special guest artists Ranin Shaar and Muhammad Mohsen. Treasures of the East builds bridges between communities by providing a forum for people to connect through the joy of Arab music and the atmosphere of such performances the National Arab Orchestra is famed for. During the second segment, I will air an interview we conducted previously with U.S. Senator James Aborisk, who passed away on February 24, 2023, at the age of 92. Senator James Aborisk was the son of Lebanese Arab immigrants who made history as the nation's first Arab American senator. James Aborisk was also the founder of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC. During that interview, we talked about several issues, including the U.S.-led war on Iraq, the rhetoric of attacks on Iran, the Lebanese-Syrian relations, nuclear weapons in the Middle East, and Israel's nuclear arsenal, the Israel lobby and its effect on U.S. policy, Israel's attack on the USS Liberty and the U.S. cover-up, and the U.S. Patriot Act and status of Arab Americans. Stay tuned for that interview. The National Arab Orchestra, known the world over for outstanding quality concerts and its innovative approach to performances, is coming to Houston for a special live performance at the Hobby Center for the Performing Arts on March 18th. The event is titled Treasures of the East, Timeless Classics of the Arab World, and is led by Michael Ibrahim. Joining us via phone from Detroit is Michael Ibrahim. Michael Ibrahim is the National Arab Orchestra founder and music director. He is a dynamic conductor. I've seen him myself, by the way, perform live in Houston several times. And he is a recognized innovator in the Arab music circuit. He performs in concert halls and venues all over the world. He has been featured on a number of recordings and film scores and has shared the stage with some of the most influential figures in Western and Arab music. Michael Ibrahim has a Master of Music degree in conducting from Wayne State University. Michael, welcome to Arab Voices.
Ahlan.
Ahlan wa sahlan. It's great to have you on the show. Could you please start by telling our listeners a brief background on the National Arab Orchestra and what led you to create it?
Well, I started this about almost 15 years ago. We're going to hit our 15th anniversary season in the fall. And it was something that just kind of came into my lap. I've been playing music and freelancing with Arab music. And I remember my teacher, Joni Sedwe, he was my first Arab teacher. He would always say he wanted to open up a school and start a group. And he had all these big dreams. And all of a sudden, I found myself an opportunity to start doing that work. And it was just a gradual thing that kept growing from there, from a small university ensemble of 6-7 students to a full-fledged institution where we perform all over the country and throughout the Arab world.
And since then, I'm on the mailing list for the National Arab Orchestra, and I see all the performances that are truly all over the place throughout the United States. And they are not just regular performances. I noticed that you usually debut some of the famous artists from really all over for those different performances that you all do, correct?
Well, we like to consider ourselves a platform for the arts. So we not only do we get some really renowned artists from the Middle East who are very, very good at their craft, we also give a platform for students or people who aren't necessarily, don't necessarily do Arab music full time, or it's not their main thing. And like, for example, at the concert coming up on the 18th in Houston, we're going to have Lilian Kherbek. She lives out in Houston, and she's in our mentorship program, and she's been working with me on a project, and she'll be singing a tune at the concert. So we like to give a platform for not only the, you know, the seasoned performer, but also for people in this country who want to have a chance to be able to partake or express their culture through the arts.
So I noticed that you also have, or I know for sure you have chapters in different cities in the U.S., including a chapter in Houston. So how does it work?
Yes.
Tell us more about those chapters, especially the Houston one.
Well, the chapters are a unique thing for the organization because it allows the NAO to work with communities across the country and help them establish a cultural scene or cultural programming of the community. We have one in San Antonio, and that has a life of its own. There's different type of programming that happens there. We have an emerging chapter in Dallas. Houston, what's really unique about Houston is we were able to get Arabs from all over the Arab world within the community to come together and work around this idea of Arab arts and bringing out the Arab message through the arts. And it's been an amazing experience being able to not only help people in different parts of the country be able to express their Arab heritage, but also the non-Arabs in those communities to give them an opportunity to be able to experience who we are as a community. So it's kind of like an extension of our mission, all these chapters.
Yeah, and also I know that you do trainings, and I've seen students from Houston, they were practicing with the National Arab Orchestra, and there were some performances where they actually were participating in that you've had in Houston before. How does that training work? Tell us more about it. And you see a lot of people asking, how do we get trained? How do we join from throughout the U.S.?
So this is part of our educational programs. Back in 2013, we got a grant from the Knight Foundation, and we started a program, and we called it Building Bridges Through Music. And the idea was to go into schools and teach students how to perform a piece of Arab music, and they get a chance to perform that piece with the NAO on a concert. So right now, I mean, obviously during COVID, we had to put a hiatus on all of our educational programming, but right now, we're going back full swing. We just finished a concert out in Detroit where we had about 62 students from two high schools perform with the NAO. In Houston, what was different and what was special about that was it wasn't tied to a school. It was the actual community that pushed their kids to participate in this outside of school. So they actually made time. It was an extracurricular activity. And it was a chance for these kids to really experience their culture in a new and different way. And our educational programming has expanded since 2013 to include the mentorship program and also school classroom demonstrations, community outreach projects. But we're very much still focused on youth education because it's really important for the young generation in our community to have a chance to experience their culture through the arts, so that they can get that sense of culture that in a unique way that you can't really get anywhere else.
You know, that is music is a universal language, as you know the most. And I like, you know, you mentioned it several times, building bridges through music. And that is obviously one of the main goals of the National Arab Orchestra. That speaks to everybody out there. So this is not just, and you mentioned it, for the Arab American community, all these performances you do, including the one in Houston, but it's really for the entire community, for everybody from across to come and enjoy and to see live performances, that rich heritage and culture. And music is a huge part of that in the Arab world, or from the Arab world.
Absolutely. Our culture is extremely artistic, and right now, non-Arabs, the only experience a non-Arab might have, or 90% of non-Arabs will have, is what they'll see on media outlets, which isn't really a perfect or accurate representation of who we are. But that's what's so great about the NAO, is that it gets you an unbiased, unfiltered look into the culture through the arts. And we get a chance as a community to showcase the best of what we have as a people.
Absolutely. Now let's talk more in detail about this upcoming special event that will be held in Houston on Saturday, March 18th. Treasures of the East, Timeless Classics of the Arab World. Tell us more about that, please.
So this is part of our overarching season theme, where we want to take people on a journey through the Arab world, really give people a taste of the diversity that we have in our part of the world. And the reason why is because you don't hear a lot of people saying that Arabs are diverse, but the reality is that we are an extremely diverse community. And we have so much to offer, and that really comes out in our art. So on Saturday, at the Hobby Center, we're going to have a Lebanese vocalist, Ranin Shahan, and an Egyptian vocalist, Mohammed Mehsin. So we're going to actually have an Egyptian who's going to sing in an Egyptian. We're going to have a Lebanese vocalist who's very versatile, who will be able to give us music from both the Levant and North Africa. And there's a beautiful blend of music. We're really excited about this program, actually. We're planning some great music for this concert.
And I cheated a little bit. So I was looking at YouTube and at the performances of Ranin Shahar and Mohammed Mohsen, and it was like, wow, I can't wait to see them in person in Houston perform. They are truly outstanding vocalists out there with their singings, with their voice, and the different styles. So that is, unlike you mentioned, the diversity of the Arab world from different countries. So that's really going to be amazing. And you yourself perform in all of these events, and you're a master at several instruments during these. And I've seen you in performing live in Houston and also on the internet at different locations.
I mean, this is my life. Music is, it's a big part of who I am. It's a big part of my identity as an Arab American. So I've really immersed myself in that culture, and as a result, I've had the opportunity to study with some great musicians, and been able to actually, I've been blessed with the opportunity to be able to learn all these different instruments, and it just really makes me feel even more proud of my heritage and culture.
Absolutely, and it's truly true and amazing performances. So let's repeat again the information to our listeners to make sure they get it correctly. First, it is titled Treasures of the East, Timeless Classics of the Arab World. And that's going to take place Saturday, March 18th at 8 p.m. Houston time. And that's at the Hobby Center for the Performing Arts, located on 800 Bagby Street. That's in downtown Houston, the Hobby Center. And if somebody wants more information about this particular event or to get tickets, they can do it through your website. Maybe you can share that with our listeners.
They can go onto our website at ArabOrchestra.org, and then they can find it under the tab of events. They can also go onto the Hobby Center's website and find it. They can also look up on our Facebook page and our Instagram page, and they'll be able to find links to for tickets on those websites as well.
And I also have links to them on our website, arabvoices.net, under the community calendar section. Any last word, Michael, you'd like to share with our listeners about the National Arab Orchestra?
Oh, I'm just excited to be back in Houston. I can't wait to be with the crowd out there. It's one of the best crowds to play for. I can't wait to see everyone March 18th.
And there is no doubt that the community and the sponsors and the supporters, you talked about them earlier, you didn't mention names, but it's a huge list of sponsors from Houston, a lot of organizations and others that are really sponsors of the National Arab Orchestra and are standing behind it, which speaks volume, and that is really great.
Absolutely. They've been the backbone of the NAO, for sure.
Excellent. The website, again, for the National Arab Orchestra, for more information, is araborchestra.org. I'd like to thank our guest, Michael Ibrahim, who is the National Arab Orchestra founder and music director, who will be in Houston performing live with other outstanding vocalists, Raneen Shaar and Mohammed Mohsen, who will be in Houston on Saturday, March 18. Michael, we are grateful for your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Looking forward to seeing you in Houston again.
Same here. See you soon.
You're listening to Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Senator James Abu Rizq passed away on February 24, 2023, at the age of 92. He was the son of Lebanese Arab immigrants. Between 1948 and 1952, James served in the United States Navy during the Korean War and was elected as a United States representative from South Dakota in 1970. He served in that role for one term before being elected as a United States Senator for South Dakota in 1972, where he served until 1979. James made history as the nation's first Arab American senator. James Abu Rizq was also the founder of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC. On the passing of U.S. Senator James Abu Rizq, ADC issued the following statement. It is with great and profound sadness that we announce the passing of ADC's founder, U.S. Senator James George Abu Rizq, a beloved member of our community. James passed away in South Dakota at the age of 92, surrounded by family and loved ones. James founded ADC in 1980, serving as our first chairperson. Under his leadership and vision, ADC became and remains the preeminent grassroots organization representing Arab Americans. ADC Chairman Dr. Safa Rifqa said, quote, "The community has lost a true leader and generational figure for Arab Americans. Our thoughts and prayers are with his wife, children, and family. Jim has left behind a legacy, and we will continue to honor and build on it here at ADC. I will forever be thankful for his leadership, guidance, and perseverance. He was always an integral part of our community, significantly contributing to the story of Arab Americans. He was a generous trailblazer, paving the way for others with his leadership. Jim always stood for what is right, and he always stood steadfast for justice here at home and abroad." Unquote. Abid Ayyub, ADC National Executive Director, said, quote, "We ask that you keep the Abu Rizq family in your thoughts and prayers during this difficult time. Generations of Arab Americans, including myself, have benefited from his work and legacy. Jim always stood for what is right and advanced the rights of our community with adventure, compassion, humor, and love. At ADC, we will honor his memory and legacy by continuing to work towards the noble mission he laid out for the organization over 40 years ago." Unquote. ADC's statement also said, "As senator, James was a voice for justice and equity, incredibly influential in advocating for the rights of indigenous peoples in the United States. He was a driving force in creating the American Indian Policy Review Commission and the Select Committee on Indian Affairs, serving as a chair for both. In his efforts to represent tribes in Congress in working toward improving federal relations, he authored two landmark pieces of legislation, the Indian Child Welfare Act and the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act." After his departure from the Senate, James was driven to create ADC after the FBI upscam operation, in which FBI agents impersonated Arabs in stereotypical and offensive fashions. He mobilized the Arab American community, spread-heading our nation's first grassroots movement dedicated to advocating for the civil rights of Arab Americans. His historic efforts helped lay the groundwork for the anti-Arab and anti-Islamophobic activism we witness today. That was a statement issued by ADC, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, that Senator James Abu Rizq founded in 1980. I had interviewed U.S. Senator James Abu Rizq on this program, Arab Voices, back in 2006. We talked about several issues, including the U.S.-led war on Iraq, the rhetoric of attacks on Iran, the Lebanese-Syrian relations, nuclear weapons in the Middle East, and Israel's nuclear arsenal, the Israel lobby and its effect on U.S. policy, Israel's attack on the U.S.'s liberty and the U.S. cover-up, the U.S. Patriot Act and status of Arab Americans. In his memory, I'm going to air now that interview that I, along with my co-host at that time, Mark Bibawi, conducted with Senator James Abu Rizq live on this program. During that interview, the senator also addressed questions from the callers. Let's listen in. Joining us over the phone is Senator James Abu Rizq. Senator Abu Rizq is of Lebanese descent. He is a lawyer, writer, and the first Arab American to serve in the U.S. Senate, representing South Dakota from 1973 until 1979, and served in the United States Navy during the Korean War. Senator Abu Rizq is founder of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, a grassroots civil rights organization committed to defending the rights of people of Arab descent and all Americans. He is author of several books, including the book Through Different Eyes, Two Leading Americans, a Jew and an Arab, Debate U.S. Policy in the Middle East. Mr. Abu Rizq, welcome to Arab Voices.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you for joining us. We're pleased to have you. And again, a reminder to our listeners that Senator James Abu Rizq will be the keynote speaker at the ADC Texas Banquet to be held on May 6th here in Houston at the Sheraton Suites Hotel by the Galleria. Mr. Abu Rizq, I would like to get your feedback first on the situation we're in now in Iraq. And I don't know if you're aware of the comments that Madeleine Albright made over the weekend. In an interview with the New York Times, she basically said that the situation now in Iraq, the invading of Iraq, is likely to go down as one of the worst U.S. foreign policy blunders ever. She said, I think Iraq may end up being one of the worst disasters in American foreign policy. What is your take on what's happening in Iraq?
Well, I'd have to agree with I didn't hear what she said, but I'd have to agree with that. That's her statement. I just cannot imagine a worse blunder for the United States than to have our troops bogged down, being killed, coming back without arms and legs, spending probably going to be $2 trillion is what the estimates are before we get out of there. And there's no real plan of any kind. We keep hearing promises from the Bush administration and the generals, or they're all we're going to start withdrawing this year. Well, let me tell you something. They're not going to withdraw nothing except token forces, because Bush feels politically he can't do so. And that's the tragedy of the whole thing. We're there for his glory, not for anybody else's glory.
And they seem to be increasing the talk about the withdrawal and how successful the situation is in Iraq, whether from some military, current military officials, or from Rumsfeld himself, Condoleezza Rice, or the president, and especially after the election or the nominations of new Iraqi leaders over the weekend. They are still yet to form an Iraqi government. Yet the violence and the destruction of the country is still there in Iraq, but they, as if they are preparing the public here that this is it, we've done a good job, and now we're going to be ready to withdraw to some extent from there.
Well, for one thing, the U.S. Military is building permanent bases in Iraq, and the reason I think they want them is to make sure that they can control all the oil countries over there from some base. That was probably part of the reason that we went into Iraq. The other part was to try to take Iraq's, get them off Israel's back. That was the other part of it. And the oil, they thought they'd have their hands full of oil. Turns out none of this has worked out very well. But if we're building permanent bases, we're sure not going to get out of there right away. If they are, they're sure wasting a lot of money on the bases that they're building.
Yes. How do you see the situation now in terms of, do you think that the current Bush administration really knew what they are in for? Did they really expect it to be as such, the situation is right now in Iraq, or are they really surprised by it now?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what they're thinking right now, but I can tell you, the people who, there's a book written by a general called Cobra II, he and a New York Times reporter, where they outline all of the mistakes and judgment that were made planning for the invasion, planning for the rebuilding afterward, and so on. And there were just tremendous, tremendous amounts of misjudgment on the part of the administration and the people. For example, Bremer, who was in charge there for a long time, fired the Iraqi army. That was their first big mistake. That's where the insurgency comes from, for the most part, is the Iraqi soldiers who were fired who have no way, who had no way to make a living. So that was, and then allowing the museum to be looted, allowing looting to take place all over the city of Baghdad. It was just a tragedy, one right after the other. So it's hard to say what they were thinking at the time. They were not thinking very clearly, that's obvious.
And actually my question should have been, or what I meant to say, is whether they really cared about what really happens on the ground in Iraq, the well-being of the Iraqi people and the infrastructure and the total destruction that occurred, versus their goal, which when you mentioned Israel, the oil and so on, Iraq has the second largest oil in the world and so on. So obviously they are not really caring about what they claim to be democracy and, you know, the new Middle East order there.
No, I don't. I mean, democracy, yeah. It's all that is talk. Look, there was democracy in the Palestinian elections. When Hamas got elected, Bush started denouncing him. That's what he thought about democracy. I guess it's democracy only if you like who got elected. So, you know, it's all talk. That's all it is. Nothing more. It's all he does. Now, nobody believes him anymore anyhow. He's gone, you know. Politically, he's gone.
Do you believe that the U.S., the Israel lobby here in the United States has effect on the U.S. foreign policy?
Well, of course, yeah. It's the Israeli supporters in the administration who pushed Bush into the war. I don't think he was smart enough to know what he was getting into, but they talked him into it. And they had their own purposes, and they probably told him, you know, we're going to save Israel, we're going to get our hands in the oil, we're going to build bases over there because we're building an American empire in the Middle East. We're going to start in the Middle East, and we need bases there to control all the oil countries. That's probably why they want the bases. So, you know, I mean, that'll all come out in 10, 15 years from now. There'll be evidence of it, but we won't see that for a while. But all you can do is just guess right now, and my guess is that's, what else could they be thinking? I mean, you know, there's certainly not any clever thinking involved there.
And speaking of guessing, I know it's a guess now whether they are going to attack Iran or not. On some weeks, they talk strongly against Iran and possible military action. Then things go for weeks without any talk about Iran or any mention about it. But who knows what the Israel lobby is after nowadays?
Well, the Israeli lobby wants us there. They're openly saying we should invade Iran and we should openly bomb them. You know, it's unbelievable that they would start thinking that way after this disaster in Iraq. First of all, we have no troops left. You know, they're all tied up in Iraq. Secondly, if we bomb Iran, the United States of America will pay a price because the Iranians won't sit still for it. And we should not be doing, you know, if they're building a nuclear weapon, which they may very well be, they're 10 years away from it. That's what all the experts say. So I don't see the urgency. What I would like to see is a nuclear-free Middle East, because the reason Iran is arming is because Israel has 200 nuclear weapons, and they're afraid of them. I guess the lesson that Iran is thinking about is if you have weapons, the United States won't invade. If you don't have weapons, they will invade. So I think they're probably trying to defend themselves from Israel and the United States. I think that's a tragedy in itself. That's why I say a nuclear-free Middle East is the only thing that's going to save this world from another war.
We are talking with Senator James Apurizek, a lawyer, a writer, and founder of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, about the Middle East, and we'll be discussing other issues also. Let me ask you another question, Mr. Apurizek, about the situation in Syria and Lebanon. Today is the first anniversary of the Syrian troops' withdrawal from Lebanon after being there for many, many years. What is your take? How do you assess the situation there now? Vis-a-vis the Syrian-Lebanese relationship, and then we'll talk also about the U.S. pressure on Syria.
Well, apparently there's not much of a relationship left. I think they're somewhat hostile to each other. I personally think that the Syrians should have pulled out a long time ago, but I don't think that Bush helped a lot, by the way, the way he humiliated Bashar al-Assad after the Hariri assassination. The other thing, you know, there's no evidence that Syria was involved in that. I have no idea. I mean, I don't know, because but there's no evidence in either side. But if I were to guess that the people who are getting assassinated or being assassinated by the Israeli secret, the Mossad, they've done that historically. They've tried to make the Arabs look bad by doing some bad things. So, you know, we may never know who's behind all these assassinations, but nevertheless, there's a way to do things and a way not to do it, and I think it was handled very badly.
And today, Ethiopia, an official visited President al-Assad to the, regarding the situation, and also today the United States administration announced that they are going to freeze the assets of anybody who is involved with the assassination of Rafiq al-Hariri. Let me go now to my co-host Mark to join us in the conversation.
Well, I've been taking calls. We had a lot of people very interested in joining the conversation as well, so we'll be going to them shortly. But I wanted to ask a little bit more about the Iran attack situation. You said that Israel is openly encouraging the U.S. to attack, at least by air. And it seems to me that your idea of a nuclear-free Iran is actually exactly the same position that the Iranians have. They said
nuclear-free Middle East.
Right. Exactly. They said earlier today, the Iranian foreign minister said, that they're willing to discuss all the nuclear options, civilian and military, and that they their foreign policy opposes nuclear weapons use at all. And they are suggesting a nuclear-free Middle East, and they're suggesting talks being set up to carry this out. Do you think that message is getting out there at all from the Iranians?
Well, I don't know. I hadn't heard that from them. I'm very glad to hear about it. I know that some Iranian foreign ministry official went to Syria here a few weeks ago, and they made a joint announcement calling for a nuclear-free Middle East, but it never got any press in this country. I wonder why.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the other point, of course, that you made is that is what would happen to the American troops in Iraq if an attack happened. Currently, the numbers are around 140,000, 150,000, plus, you know, we shouldn't forget the American troops in Afghanistan, which is probably about another 20,000 or 30,000 troops. And they would be within striking distance of Iranian weapons. So one has to question the wisdom of all of this.
Well, I'm not sure that Iran would attack any troops in Iraq. But what they could do, because they have influence over the Shia population in Iraq, they could make great trouble for the United States. They could make great trouble in South Lebanon with the Hezbollah. They could make trouble anywhere they wanted to, because they'd have a way of fighting back that would be very difficult for America. And I think that's something if Bush is interested in protecting the United States, he ought to be very careful how he treads over there.
All right. We do have so many callers on hold already wanting to join the conversation. Let's go ahead and take our first caller for the evening. Let's go to line one.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Senator, I'd like you to discuss. I've talked to some people that have relatives, that have friends that have relatives over in Iraq. And I like to enlighten on to you what's really going on about how terrible the situation is for our troops over there. I talked to a lady the other day, says that she has not heard from her son in months. And that last time, no emails, no communications whatsoever. And I've noticed that the more troops that they interview on television, they surely look dejected. And you could tell that their uniforms look like they've been patched up. The troops are actually having trouble getting supplies now. The resistance is well coordinated, and they are basically picking them off one by one. And as far as you're talking about the situation with Iran, us attacking Iran, I've read some reports on the internet that Iran definitely has air defense capability, and they'll be able to knock out our aircraft. And I want you to comment on all this, if you would, please.
Well, first of all, I would hope that we're supplying the troops. We sent them there. We ought to protect them and do what we can for them while they're there.
Right.
We don't want to blame them for what the political decisions are. So I would certainly hope that, they've been talking about having provided everything for the troops over there, and I hope that's true. But if not, I think somebody in Congress ought to start raising heck about it. Secondly, what was your second part of your question?
About the scenario of attacking Iran, that actually I've read reports on the internet that, the Iranian military is not like the Iraqi military. They definitely have defensive capabilities. They have ways to actually track our aircraft and shoot them down, and all kind of other air defense artillery.
Well, you're right. They have a tough army there, and the U.S. is the most powerful country in the world. Nobody could really defeat us. We can only defeat ourselves. But I, you know, why get into a war against Iran? There's no real reason to. There's other ways to negotiate this nuclear thing. Many other ways. In fact, what they just told me about the Iranian foreign minister said they're willing to negotiate. It's all up for negotiation. So why not do that instead of saber rattling? It makes much more sense. You would that Bush would have learned his lesson after getting bogged down in Iraq, but apparently not.
Let's go and take line three.
Yeah, I want to know if you think the people in the Middle East know that 911 was an inside job, and if you think it would be a good idea for Amy Goodman to go ahead and tell everybody.
You know what you mean by an inside job. You got me there. Tell me, explain that to me.
Well, actually, we just dropped the caller. I think he's trying to imply, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that there may be something to this, that there is at least some form of cover-up going on, because the official version of 9/11 seems to make very little sense in the face of the evidence. I don't know what your opinion is on that.
Well, I don't. All I know is what I saw on television, that the planes were hijacked. They crashed into it very tragically. That's all I know. I don't know anything about any conspiracy or any cover-up. I have no knowledge of anything like that, so I can't comment on it.
Well, for our listeners who may be interested in pursuing the topic, a couple of good books to read is New Pearl Harbor by David Ray Griffin. Let's just leave it at that for now, and maybe we'll attack the subject some other time.
All right, let's take caller on line two.
Just kind of a comment question. It seems to be the U.S., but who put the U.S. in charge of nuclear power around the world, number one? It seems they're the ones that are being the nuclear police for the world. And number two, if we're trying to make a nuclear-free Middle East, why not make a nuclear-free U.S.? If they're the most powerful country, the leader, they could make examples, make a nuclear-free U.S. That way, maybe other countries will follow and see where it goes from there. And that's my comment and question, if you could answer those.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Well, I don't disagree with that at all. I think what the U.S. ought to do is not only create a nuclear-free Middle East, including Israel, that's the big button over there right now. But they also ought to negotiate nuclear weapons degradation with other countries such as Russia, China, anybody who has nuclear weapons, they ought to get rid. You know that all five members of the permanent members of the Security Council, France, England, China, United States, Britain, I guess I said that. Anyhow, they all are nuclear powers. But they're the ones who ought to negotiate the degradation of the weapons and get rid of them all, including anybody in the world who has them. Look at Pakistan and India, how close we've come to seeing a nuclear battle there. It just is not good for the world. It's not good for humanity.
And talking about nuclear weapons in the Middle East, Israel right now is the only country in the Middle East that refuses to sign the non-proliferation treaty.
That's true.
And they also refuse to allow UN inspectors in, which is another issue.
Yes. Let's take line four.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I'd like to advance a note of interrogation. I want you to think about what I'm saying because, do you do understand why Saudi Arabia is able to export as much oil as it does? And Bahrain and UAE and all those countries, because they have small populations, and they don't need as much oil domestically. So they're able to export more. If they had a large population, they would need more oil for domestic purposes.
That's
now,
true.
Now, okay, let's take Iraq. Militarily, you can't understand what's going on in Iraq. But from the perspective of people who are running the oil businesses, all of those Iraqis who are dying will only help them in the future, because Iraq will need less oil domestically and they can export more. So give that some thought when you think of what's going on in Iraq that doesn't make any sense. Militarily, it doesn't. And the generals are not planning this. But those crooks in the oil business...
So are you suggesting that the oil business is deliberately looking to target Iraqi civilians to increase Iraq's output?
I'm suggesting, because then we never get any figures on the number of Iraqis that are dying, and you know there are quite a few. Whenever they decide that that's enough, then Iraq won't need as much oil domestically, it'll be more available for them to steal.
Well, that's an interesting theory, and I'd like to see you back it up with some evidence at some point. So if you find that, please give us a call back, and we'll get you on the air again.
Okay, it's obvious that what is happening in Iraq makes no sense militarily.
I think we understand your point, but like I said, it's a strong allegation, and you'd need some evidence for us to be able to discuss it further.
Okay, I said give it some thought,
okay? Sure.
All right, bye-bye.
Hey,
thanks
you.
For your call. Okay, let's take line one again.
Hi. You know, it's been proven over and over that America is just a bully. They're doing everything ass backwards, and I blame most of this on Cheney. Everyone keeps saying Bush. I think the devil in the house that you need, the fox in the hen house you need to be looking at is Cheney. And if they would give the, what was it, $50 billion that was in that oil reserve account, had they given it to the Iraqis, like you said, instead of firing Bremer when he first went in, if he'd have given it, instead of firing the police department and the army and all, given the money to them, they have their own engineers. I mean, they would be up and running with water and oil and, electricity, everything that they need right now. But because we keep stealing from them, besides bombing them, preaching democracy, I mean, these people keep tearing up the lines. They don't want it to go up for Americans just to rob it. I mean, that doesn't take much, sense to figure that out. And I think the devil that everyone needs to be looking at here over there is Israel. I'm sorry, but Israel would stab us in the back and bomb us or anything that, or anybody.
They've already done that.
Yes, but they would do it to us again. I mean, in a New York
minute,
Israel would turn on us.
Okay. Let's give the senator a chance to...
Israel destroyed the USS Liberty and killed a bunch of U.S. sailors in 1967 on a intelligence ship that we had out in the Mediterranean.
That's a very little known incident. Do you want to give just a few more details about that?
Well, just that we had an intelligence ship out there called the USS Liberty. I know the crew members. I've spoken at their reunions. They were ordered to go out there, and Israel came along with jets, bombed them, and they came with torpedo boats and machine gunned the life rafts that when people were trying to escape, and they killed and wounded a couple hundred people of our sailors. Then the Johnson administration covered it up. They wouldn't investigate it. Nobody will investigate it to this day because I guess they don't want to embarrass Israel. But Jim Bamford, who's written a book on U.S. intelligence, said that there was a U.S. intelligence plane flying over at the time and heard the Israelis saying that we're going to target this ship. They knew it was an American ship. And they've sent spies over here. There's a case going on right now on Washington, D.C., in the area there.
The Larry Franklin case you're referring to?
The Franklin case, yeah, mm-hmm. Where these two guys from the Israeli lobby, from AIPAC, were getting secrets from Larry Franklin, who was in the U.S. administration, and it was about Iran, secrets on Iran. He was passing them to the Israeli lobby, and which then gave them to Israel. And then there was Jonathan Pollard. They've spied on us, and we still give them several billion dollars a year, $6 billion or more a year, out of the U.S. Treasury.
Well, I guess one would have to question the need even to go to Larry Franklin when members of AIPAC are as senior as Paul Wolfowitz and so on. But do you have any comment on what the listener said about the Iraqis' proven ability in the past to rebuild damaged areas? I mean, it took them 3 weeks to get electricity and water back online as the bombing started, but now it's taken 3 years and nothing's happened. What's your comment on that?
Well, I mean, what can I say? You know, it's the rebuilding effort is a failure. It's just not much is happening. We're spending a lot of money. I saw on the television news, on one of the network news shows tonight, that there were several billion dollars stolen from some of the money we sent over there to rebuild. Just absolutely stolen by American contractors.
Yeah, I think, there were several issues of money that's gone missing. The General Accounting Office of Congress did an audit and found $9 billion in cash disappeared.
Yeah, there
that's,
you go.
That's quite separate from the contractors that have overcharged various items.
No, they were charged, but they just, tonight they said on CBS News, I think, that somebody stole the money. It was American contractors.
Right.
So there's no oversight. There's nobody watching the thing. They're just giving our money away, our taxpayers' money, all for the glory of the Bush administration. And she's right about Cheney, by the way.
Okay, I do want to ask you about the U.S. Patriot Act and where do you see the situation for Arab Americans here. But before I do that, let me take another call or two from our listeners. Let's go now to line two.
Well,
hi.
Well, I got so many things to say, but I know time is short. First of all, what do you think, how do you think the Democrats should be dealing with this? I know they demonize the Palestinians, but I just have the feeling that, you know, they're just not playing up to all the things that are going on, so we can get some kind of a balance in our government to kind of, you know, avoid these problems with Iran and everybody.
Well, with some exceptions, the Democrats are very cowardly on this issue of Iraq and the Bush administration's incompetence. They're very cowardly. They're afraid to say. You've got Hillary Clinton out there saying we ought to send more troops over, and a couple other of these presidential candidates who are Democrats. I don't know. I'm a Democrat, but I've almost given up on the party. My God, they're awful.
What do you make of the main reason for this cowardice?
I think what they've all got consultants who tell them, keep your head down, don't do anything controversial. But, you know, Paul Wellstone, the Minnesota senator who died in a plane crash, I think 6 days before the election, he voted against the Iraq war. And his poll ratings went up, but nobody ever learned from him. I mean, you learn that if you've got some political courage, people appreciate it. But they don't do that. They just, the Democrats are just cowardly. They're failures, you know.
Well, quick apologies to that caller for cutting you off, because we are running very short of time inside. We have one more person on the line already, so.
Okay, so if you have any question for our guest, who is Senator James Abu-Rizek, a lawyer, writer, and founder of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee and the first Arab American to serve in the U.S. Senate.
Saeed, before you jump to the next caller, I just had a caller who said, I like the senator, you should give out his name more. So can you spell the name for those who don't have access to the web? If you have access to the web, go to arabvoices.net and you'll see all the details. But if you don't, get a pen and paper and make a note of the spelling. Saeed, go ahead.
That's Senator James Abu-Rizek. James is J-A-M-E-S. Last name is A-B-O-U-R-E-Z-K. And again, you can go to our website and you'll see more information about him at arabvoices.net. Mr. Abu-Rizek, what is your take on the status of the Arab Americans now in light of the U.S. Patriot Act and what happened on September 11th and so on? If you can give us briefly your assessment.
Well, Arab Americans have been hammered by the Justice Department, by the administration, basically. They rounded up thousands of Arab Americans after the 9/11 attack as though they were all terrorists. And they detained them, put them in jail, kept them there, wouldn't let them talk to their lawyers. I don't know how many are still in jail now. There are some in jail. I don't know how many there are. We've got to get a good grip on that. But ADC has, we don't have a lot of money, but we have five lawyers working on our staff in Washington. And the Homeland Security Department tells us that 75% of the complaints they get, the cases that they get, come from ADC. So we're doing the best we can with what little budget we have. We've spent a lot of money hiring lawyers, and we do the best job we can to get people out of jail, to get them represented somehow. We've got law firms in Washington who are doing free work at our request. We're helping out in that regard. So, I can just tell you there's still a big problem for Arab Americans, because they've kind of smeared everybody with the same brush. At very difficult times for our community and for us to try to help them out.
Is the ADC doing any work on Guantanamo?
No, we haven't done anything there, but we do it mostly around the country.
Okay.
Okay, and I want to save our questions for some other time, because we only have about 7 minutes left for the show, and we still have several callers on hold. So we want to go ahead and take their calls. I want to ask the remaining callers to just please ask a short question, and we will be dropping the line after you ask the question. Let's take now line one.
Yes, Senator, welcome. You really touched on something just now, on something I was about to ask you. And that is, I don't know what's happening to the Arab Americans, the grassroots. I know. I was very happy, you know, to serve your organization back in the 80s and also another Arab American organization. They seem to me morally defeated. I don't know. We used to work very good, very well back in the 80s with the mainstream Americans. Today, the most of them are really just hanging around with, you know, a lot of these lefties and peaceniks, and they are sneering really the Arabs as a whole, because they get associated only with this group. And just like on the station where you're talking about, you don't reach ever to the mainstream American. You're actually preaching to the choir. So tell me, what could be done? Every time I approach him here, you know, every one of them has his own idea, but they're really not doing much, whole lot at all in reaching the mainstream American public. And I'd like to have your comment on that.
Well,
Thank you, sir.
I tell you, we have a very small, you know, money's the mother's milk of politics. We're in politics. And we just have very little budget. If we had more budget, we could do an awful lot more. It's just that we do what we can with what money we have, and we're spread thin.
But the Arab community surely is not short of money, and the Arabs have a reputation of being very rich. What can you do to raise more money?
They don't know how to contribute. You know, they just don't do it. You explain it to me. I don't know why. I've tried for years to try to get them to drop in money on the ADC to give us a chance to fight. You know, but it's very difficult to get money out of Arab Americans, even the rich ones, especially the rich ones. We have some good supporters. And we have a lot of people in our membership group, but we don't make much money off that. It's just very difficult to operate in politics without money. So that's really the problem. Now, we do our best to try to get the mainstream America to hear what we've got to say. And, we just do what we can. And I know it's not a tremendous success, but we do what we can. We try hard.
And for more information about the ADC, visit their website at adc.org. And we here on Arab Voices, we try our best to bring all these issues and bringing these experts to talk to the American public, to everybody out there. And yes, a lot of people listen and tune into our show other than people who agree with our viewpoint. And that's very evident from the tons of email we receive all the time from the people who are speaking against what we are doing here and so on. But anyway, let's take more calls. Just a few minutes left. Let's take call number two.
Hi there, Senator. I just have one small question. I mean, we've been hearing all these allegations and accusations, and we know that we have been digging deeper and deeper ourselves in a big hole, and we know Iraq has been a disaster. But what do you think is a solution? Is anybody pointing at a solution? How do we get ourselves out of this?
Well, there's a couple ways to get out of it. Remember they used to say during the Vietnam War, just declare victory and leave, which we couldn't do until 60,000 Americans were killed over there. In this situation, we've got 2,400 Americans have been killed, but a lot more, several thousand more come back without arms and legs. It's a tragedy, an absolute tragedy that ought to end right away. So my suggestion is if the politicians are afraid to do it, why don't they just say, look, let's get them out of there and let's go on a manhunt in Afghanistan looking for Osama bin Laden. Put them all over there and then get them out. You know, it's not so dangerous there right now. Get them out of there and then pull them back home as soon as we can. I'm for pulling them out tomorrow as soon as we can do it. Get them out. That's my position.
Sorry to interrupt you. Do you think that the pressure on the Iraqi government to form a unity government is related somehow to getting them to ask the Americans to leave so that it would look like it was an Iraqi decision, not an American one?
I've been thinking about that a lot. Why don't they ask the Iraqis to ask us to leave? That's probably what they're doing. That's probably what they're getting to, but who knows what's going on inside their heads.
All right. Let's take one more call. Line three.
Hello, Senator.
Hi.
Hi. I tend to be politically conservative myself, and I was just listening tonight just for fun. But on the subject of Israel, I do have some problems with the Israeli policy, but a few things. It was established in 1948 by the UN.
What would your opinion?
I'm sorry?
Just a minute.
What would your opinion be about? I can't hear you. I'm sorry.
Can you wait a minute?
Okay.
Let me just say that's a mistake. It was not formed by the UN. The General Assembly voted to create Israel as a state, but the General Assembly votes are not binding. By the way, it's a Security Council that votes are binding. and they never voted to create Israel. But so therefore, it was never done by the UN. That's a bit of propaganda the Israelis have put out for years. So go ahead then.
Well, I'm saying if they went back to their 48 borders, would you be willing to guarantee their security or have some sort of UN or even U.S. Policy to guarantee that if they were to withdraw to their 48 borders?
Well, you mean the 67 borders, probably.
Well, okay, but yeah, 67, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
established
yes,
in 48,
in fact,
not changed to 67.
I've advocated that for years. If they'd withdraw to the 67 borders, the Arabs would all sign a peace treaty with them. They've all told me that. I met with every Arab leader over there except Saddam Hussein. And they all told me, the Saudis, the Lebanese, the Syrians, everybody, if they get back behind their 67 border, we'll sign a peace treaty with them. And yes, the U.S. should guarantee. I don't know why you'd have to guarantee. They've got the fourth most powerful military in the world. I don't know why anybody should guarantee, but if that's what they want, let's do it.
And guarantee it beyond what we already have is hard to imagine.
Yeah, let's end the occupation. Let's end the humiliation and the suffering of the Palestinians over there. That would do an awful lot toward creating peace and getting rid of the terrorism that's affecting us right now. Because a lot of it's based on our policy toward Israel and Palestine.
And the two most disastrous areas right now in the Middle East are Iraq and Palestine.
Right.
The answer is simply one thing. There is a foreign military occupation, the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the U.S. occupation, the U.S.-led
exactly.
occupation of Iraq. We are almost out of time. Our guest, Senator James Aburizek, who has been with us for the past 45 minutes, will be the keynote speaker at the Texas event on May 6th. If you need more information about that or to purchase tickets, contact Dania, and we have more details about this on our website, arabvoices.net. Senator James Aburizek, we want to thank you so much for the time this evening.
Yeah, thank you, and thank your listeners.
Thank you very much. We're pleased to have you with us.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
What you just heard was an interview we conducted with U.S. Senator James Aburizek on this program, Arab Voices, back in 2006. Senator James Aburizek was the son of Lebanese Arab immigrants who made history as the nation's first Arab-American senator. James Aburizek was also the founder of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC. He passed away on February 24, 2023, at the age of 92. May he rest in peace. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.